Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, author Isabel Allende. I've been so fortunate to speak with Isabel many times over the years about her books, her life, and her long writing career. At the end of March, she joined me for a live virtual event where we discussed her new memoir, The Soul of a Woman. Isabel Allende is the author of 25 books, including The House of Spirits, Eva Luna, and Paula. Having lived as a refugee herself, she's a champion of human rights around the world, with a focus on the treatment of women. Now in her late 70s, Allende draws on these experiences in her new book, in which she reflects on feminism in our society and in her personal life. The following is an edited version of our conversation. There you are.
I am here. How are you, Diane?
I'm fine.
I'm so pleased to see you.
And I am so pleased to see you. You're out there in California now.
I am, yes. Very happily in my little attic here in California, which I call my den, in my little house of the spirits.
Where you do all of your writing, where you close yourself away for the day and do all your writing.
Yes. And during the pandemic, I had what I had been craving for years, time, silence, and solitude. So I could write that book, The Soul of a Woman, which we're talking about today, and a novel that I finished in December.
Wow.
And I hope to publish by the beginning of next year, because now it's in the process of translation. So it was a very productive year, and it was also a year of a honeymoon, because I married shortly before the pandemic, and then we were caught in this eternal honeymoon in this small house. So we are still stuck here. I don't know if the marriage is going to survive so much intimacy.
Tell me about Roger, your brand new husband.
Well, I divorced from my previous husband, from Willie, when I was 72. And everybody said, are you crazy? After 28 years of marriage, why would you divorce now? So I got out of that relationship. And 2 years later, I got an email from a guy in New York. And he started writing to me every morning and every evening for 6 months. We never even talked on the phone. But my assistant at the time, Chandra, who loved detective stories, found out everything she could about him. Diane, you can't imagine how much you can find out about any person, every private person, even the license of his car. And so by the time I met him 6 months later, I knew a lot about him, but he knew more about me.
He knew more about you.
Of course, because I have a very, very explicit website.
Exactly.
I have written memoirs.
Exactly.
And 3 days later, he wanted to get married. And I replied what you would have replied, Diana. Look, marriage is out of the question, but we can be lovers. He sort of, what would he say? Yes, of course. And so we were lovers, but one in California and the other one in New York. For a year. That didn't work very well.
That doesn't work very well.
So eventually he sold his house, gave away everything it contained, and moved in with me here in this little house. And
well,
then the pandemic hit.
You have no idea how similar my story is to yours.
Wow.
When my husband of 54 years died, I said I would never marry again. And what happens? But 3 years later, a man wrote to me and said he had known me many years ago. And we began corresponding. And I met him on book tour. And here we are now married.
How long have you been married?
It will be our fourth wedding anniversary.
Lovely.
October.
Lovely. Well, I hope my marriage lasts 4 years. That would be nice.
I hope it does too.
Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, I adored this book, The Soul of a Woman, because it speaks to me. It speaks to all women. It speaks from truth and from the heart. And you talk about yourself as a feminist, going back to the earliest years of childhood. How did that happen?
Of course, it wasn't called feminism then. I was born in the 40s. I'm 78 years old.
And I'm 84.
Oh, wow, you see, two elder ladies, two
exactly.
good witches. And I was living in my grandfather's house with some bachelor uncles because my father abandoned my mother after 4 years of marriage and she had three babies.
He walked away.
We never saw him again.
Wow.
But it's not that he disappeared. He just walked away from the family. And my mother had to return to live in her father's house. My grandmother died. And so it was a household of males where my mother was in a very vulnerable position. She was a sort of charity case. She was not prepared to work. She had three babies. She had no money, no independence. And at that time in Chile, there was no divorce. Divorce happened in Chile in 2004. Can you imagine? So my mother was separated. And that meant that she was like a single mother with three kids. Very pretty also, and sort of flirtatious. So she had to take very good care of her reputation, which meant that she had no freedom at all. So no freedom, no resources, nothing, no husband. And I saw my mother so fragile, so dependent, and so poor. I didn't want to be that way. So I was very angry at the situation, angry at the male authority of my grandfather and my uncles, and angry at how unfair the situation was for women. For my mother and the maids in the house. At the time, we had several maids in the house, and they lived like slaves. So I was an angry kid, a terribly angry kid, rebellious, defiant. And that wasn't called feminism then, of course, but it was very, very particular anger against male authority. But I was expelled from the nuns at age 6. That gives you an idea of the
you
kind of child I was.
Expelled. Because they said you were impossible to deal with.
Which was not true. I think that I was expelled because of my mother's situation. Because she was separated from my father. Because, you know, I think that was the real reason.
How did that affect your feeling about Catholicism?
I left the church very, very rapidly. By age 15, I walked away from the church, never went back. And it wasn't because I didn't believe in God. That came later. It was because I couldn't stand the idea of the priest. Yeah, I thought it was disgusting.
So what did you think about yourself in those years when the nuns threw you out, when you were rebellious? What did you think about yourself?
I don't remember. I don't think I thought about myself. I thought a lot about the world. And I was a very unhappy kid, introverted, sensitive. I was aware of everything in ways that most kids are. But not, kids today are very busy. They're overscheduled. And everybody's like watching them. I grew with mild neglect, which is the perfect way of growing up for a child. You have to fend for yourself. I was always sort of afraid, scared of everything, of the devil, of ghosts, of that my mother would die and we would end up in an orphanage, that my father would show up and claim us, that all kinds of ideas in my head. So I wouldn't relive one day of my childhood. But an unhappy childhood is a good foundation for life.
And a good foundation for a writer, you've said, because you had to deal with all of these issues.
Yes, and I realized that my writing always goes back to the first memories that are so strong in my mind, but also in my heart. For example, the voice of my grandfather that is permanently in my head, that is like the voice of consciousness. So I don't know. It's the voice that forces me to perform, to obey, to be better, to comply, to that things that I don't do anymore, but also taught me, don't complain, don't whine, don't expect anything because no one is going to give you anything. That has served me very well along my life. I don't need it now, but I did need it many times in my life.
How and when did you begin to write? Seemed to me you were very reluctant to write in the beginning. You didn't believe you had the talent to fit in with what you were being asked to do until you were finally forced to put words on paper.
I grew up being a very good reader, and I belong to the first generation of Latin American writers to grow up reading other Latin American writers, the great writers of the boom. Diana, they were all male. There was not one female voice in the boom. And there were no role models. The idea that I could be a writer seemed so pretentious, so ambitious, that it didn't cross my mind. I was a journalist and a very happy one for a while until we had a military coup. I had to get out of my country and couldn't find a job as a journalist in Venezuela or for the rest of my life. I couldn't find a job in that area. But eventually I became a writer as an exercise in nostalgia. I was living in exile. My marriage was collapsing. My children were going to university.
How many children?
Two children, two. Paula and Nicholas. And I felt that my life was flat. I wasn't going anywhere. I was almost 40 years old, and I had all this stuff inside that I couldn't express. And I started a letter for my grandfather, who was dying in Chile, and that letter became The House of the Spirits, my first novel.
And what happened with that book?
It sort of exploded.
It really did. It exploded.
It was one of the very few times that a first novel hits the mark. And it was published in September in Spain, in September of 1982. And by October, it was the Frankfurt Fair. And my agent took the book to the Frankfurt Fair, and every language in Europe bought the book. And I was living in Venezuela, and I didn't get wind of what was going on in Europe until a year later.
Wow. Tell me about the woman Carmen Balcells and what she meant for your career.
Carmen Balcells was the most famous agent for Spanish literature, or literature in Spanish, because she represented all the great writers of the boom from Latin America also. She was this Catalan woman, larger than life. I mean, a force of nature. And she believed in me and believed in the book. When the book was published, she invited me to Spain and threw out a party that was for all the inteligentsia of Barcelona and Madrid.
Wow.
And I didn't know anybody, was dressed like a hippie, and I am shy in groups. I don't do well in groups. So I was really having a hard time. And Carmen told me several things. One thing that she said is, don't you worry. Here, we are all improvising. And I have never forgotten that. When I go into a place where I feel shy, I feel out of place, I think, they are all improvising. I'm fine. And the other thing she said, which has been a prophecy, she said, as a woman, you will have to do double or three times the effort of any man to get half the recognition and respect. And then there was a pause, and she added, don't worry, you can do it.
And there was also your grandmother, who believed that you were going to be someone, something very special.
My grandmother was clairvoyant. And she spent her short life experimenting with telepathy and moving objects without touching them and summoning the spirits of the dead on the dining room table. I have the table here in California now, a heavy Spanish oak table that you cannot move easily. But apparently the ghosts did. And my grandmother, when I was born, said that they didn't have to worry about me because I was born with a lucky star. And that I would always have good skin and good luck. And it happened.
And I can see your skin is beautiful.
Well, that's the light, Diane.
But when that book, The House of the Spirits, was published, I mean, what did it do to you when all of a sudden, a year later, you find out that this book has truly created magic for you?
It changed my life. It gave me a voice when I didn't have a voice, when I had been silenced. It paved the way for all the books that I would write later. It gave me a purpose. And I found that what I am good at, the only thing I'm good at, is telling stories. Mm. I can always remember a good story. I can't remember names or places, but I can remember events. If there is a good story somewhere, I never forget it. And I love reading stories and writing them, so that I found my calling.
How do you feel about men these days, considering what you have been through and the marriages that have failed?
It's a very general question, because men, which men are we talking about? If I think of the young men that are marching with women in the streets for the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter or women's protests, they are the sons and the grandsons of women like me. And they understand that the patriarchy makes everybody miserable. So that's a group. But I have a foundation that works with women's organizations in many places in the world. And the conditions of women in many places is harsher than cattle. I mean, women are still sold into premature marriage, forced labor, prostitution. There is genital mutilation. There is abuse, femicide all over with total impunity. The violence against women is the greatest humanitarian crisis of the world. And we don't call it what it is. It's a war against women. And we have to call it that so that we create the awareness of what is the real reason why women live in fear. And that's most women in the world, for obvious reasons. And here in the West, we say, okay, we have gained so many rights. We are protesting pronouns. We are in the details of feminism. Well, that is not really true. That can be apparent. But if you look at it really, you will see that even women here are born and raised in fear. We are told very young, be careful what you wear. Don't use provocative clothes. Beware where you go at night. Don't go into the bar alone. Don't you hitchhike. Don't you do that. And a list of the things that men do without even thinking, and we have to be cautious about, because there are predators out there, and we are the victims. But the predators are not told not to be predators. We are told to be careful. So we have to take care of a problem that is not really ours. We are the victims.
So this is why it seems to me, having written your book now, makes so much sense. This book, The Soul of a Woman, talks not only about your own soul, very frankly, but talks about the world in which women live and how we live and how we survive.
I have been working with women and for women all my life. I know them very well. And to write this book, I had to do some research, but very little, because I had all this in my heart. This has been my life experience. I just saw a fantastic documentary called The Glorias. You have to watch it. It's about Gloria Steinem and the beginning of the women's movement in the United States. And that is the time when I was a journalist in Chile, because we are contemporaries, she and I. And I related to everything that she tells. But in my case, it happened on steroids, because it was the south of the world in the 50s and 60s. And we hadn't heard about the women's movement there at that time. So it was way worse.
Way worse.
Yeah.
You have so much to share with women in this country because of what you've been through yourself and the life you've lived and the books you've written. You established your foundation, as I recall, after your daughter Paula died. Tell us about Paula.
Of course, the death of my daughter is the worst thing that ever happened to me, ever. It cannot be compared to anything else.
She died of porphyria.
She died of neglect in a hospital in Madrid.
Ah.
Porphyria did not kill her. It was neglect. And porphyria should not kill anybody nowadays, because
I've read about it.
There is treatment. Yeah, I have two granddaughters with porphyria. One of them had four crises in 6 months during the pandemic. Oh. Now she's on a treatment and she has not had any other crisis. And when it happens, it's manageable. But in Paula's case, they didn't manage it. And she ended up in a coma and they didn't monitor the coma. So she ended up with severe brain damage. It was a very tragic thing, but my life is not tragic. My life is a happy life, in spite of all the things that seem so tragic. You were asking about how the foundation started. After she died, I wrote that book, Paula. And after the book was published, I fell in a sort of void. My life had no meaning. I had all this time in my hands, the time that I had spent with her, and now she wasn't there. And I had no desire to write anything. I was just empty. And someone said, you have to fill your reservoirs. You are empty. So I ended up going to India with my friend Tabra and my husband then, Willie. And we rented a car and we were in Rajasthan, you know, on a rural trip with a driver. It was very hot. The engine got very hot, so we stopped to cool the engine. And my friend Tabra and I, we walked toward a group of women that were under a tree, very poor, poor women with a bunch of little kids. And we had bought bracelets in a market. And so we gave the women the bracelets and we couldn't talk, but we touched, you know, and we smiled and we blessed the kids. And then it was time to go back to the car because the driver was honking. So we walked back to the car and one of the women ran behind me and she gave me this little parcel of rags. And I thought she was trying to give me something back for the bracelets. And I said, no, it's not necessary. But she insisted. And so I opened the rags and inside was a newborn baby. I don't think the baby was more than a day old. Oh. It had the umbilical cord raw there.
Oh.
And I kissed the baby, blessed the baby and tried to give it back and she wouldn't take it. And in that moment, the driver came running, this big man with a turban. He took the baby from me, gave it to the first woman that he could find there and pushed me into the car. And when we were driving away, I reacted like a minute later. And I said, why would that woman want to give me her baby? And the driver said, she was a girl. Who wants a girl?
Oh.
And that was the moment when I knew what I had to do with the income that came from the book and from my future books. And I created this foundation whose mission it is to help women like that woman that gave the baby and like that girl.
Now, tell me, so our listeners know, how do people reach out to that foundation?
If you Google my name, the first thing that appears on there is my website and the website of the foundation. We get a lot of people asking how they can donate to the foundation, and even people who want to have fundraisers for the foundation. And what we always tell them is there is a list of 100, more or less 100 organizations and programs that we support. Donate directly to them.
Now, we just received a comment from a listener who says, in the soul of a woman, you mentioned the huge response you received from readers of Paula. She says, I also felt a deep connection with that book and recall that Maya Angelou said, people will never forget how you made them feel. How do you feel about that book years later, given the kind of response you got to that book?
I think it's the most important book I have written. The most famous is The House of the Spirits, probably because it has been in the market so long.
Yes.
But Paula is the one that got me connected to millions of people. Look, 28 years have gone by, and I get letters, messages about Paula, like the message that this person sent to you right now, all the time, several a week, because everybody has losses. Yes. It's not necessarily the loss of a child, which is the worst kind of loss, but you lose it. Sometimes you lose hope, just hope, or you lose a husband or a pet or something that breaks your heart. And from a broken heart, the connection starts.
You know, you also say that in the absence of ambition you had early on, you had good luck. Talk about that good luck.
As I said before, I didn't have the idea of a career. Yeah. I didn't call myself a writer until I had 3 books in translation. Because for me, it was like a fluke that it just happened and it would never happen again. It took me at least 3 or 4 books to realize that I could make it happen, that it could be a job. It would be my day job. I could quit the other job. But when I say that I have been lucky, it's because I have, in risky moments, in moments of violence, in moments of great stress, and I have always escaped in time. The only time that I couldn't escape from tragedy was with my daughter. I felt that I could always get out. I could get out of the military coup. I could get out of poverty. I could get out of marriages that didn't work. But I could, of course, not get out of the fact that I had my daughter in a coma in my arms for a year. And so when I say I was lucky, it's because so many people write extraordinary first books and they don't get the attention they deserve.
Yes.
And some people write and they are recognized after they are dead. And they never know the impact that they have caused, you know. So in a way, I have had the good luck of good publishers, and I have very loyal readers that once they read one of my books, they keep reading them all. So that's good luck, too.
Another question from a listener. Is being bilingual and multicultural an advantage as a writer? How do you think this has shaped the way you see the world?
I have been an eternal foreigner. I started my life as the daughter of a diplomat. Then my mother married another diplomat. And as a child, I traveled with my stepfather, following him in his different places where he was working. And then I became a political exile, a refugee after the military coup in Chile, and eventually an immigrant in the United States. And when I go back to Chile, I feel like a foreigner in Chile as well, because I have been away for too long. I think that being having more than one language, if you can have multiple languages, it's even better. Language is like blood. It connects to a certain reality. It's a way of thinking, a way of seeing the world. If you speak Italian in Rome, it's not the same as speaking Danish in Denmark, because your vision of the world, the way you see the world and you describe and narrate the world is different. Even the sound of languages gives you a rhythm, an internal rhythm. And I think that that is great for a writer, but great for just anybody. It's too bad that in this country, people think that with English, it's enough, that Jesus spoke English. If you speak another language, you have a much bigger vision of the world. You connect better. And traveling has helped me, of course. It's very inspirational. But now I just want to stay put in my little house. And enough is enough. I have seen the world. I don't want to see any more of it.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Isabel Allende.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with author Isabel Allende. Her new memoir is The Soul of a Woman. You know, this memoir is about feminism, but it's also a book about getting older and what that means as a woman. How do you feel about your age? How do you feel about your place in the world as an older woman?
Well, one thing is the look, and another thing is how you feel. For years and years, I tried to emulate the role model that we have in the media, the magazines, the television, Hollywood, etc. And it's a useless proposition because I don't have the raw material. I am 5 feet tall and I'm Latina. I will never look like that. But there's a point in life, and I have fortunately reached there, where it doesn't matter. Where it doesn't matter so much that you are not like everybody else, and you stop comparing, and you become aware of who you are. So now I know that I am 5 feet tall. I will never grow. I will probably shrink. And I will never look better than today. Tomorrow I will look a little worse than today because it's another day added to my age, but I don't care. I try to look the best I can now, and I know myself well, so I don't make the same mistakes. You will not see me in shorts and platform shoes because it's the fashion. No, I have my own way of dressing and putting on my makeup and doing my hair, and I'm happy with how it is right now. Now, getting old, if you have not taking care of your health is a real problem. I think that in my case, I am so happy in this time of my life because I'm strong and I have good health. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful. And because I have resources, I'm not worrying about how am I going to pay the electricity bill. The problem with getting old, and now people live 20 or 30 years more than their parents or grandparents.
Yeah.
So life is extended, but not the quality of life. After you retire, 5 years later, you have run out of money. Your money is not enough. Your healthcare is bad, especially in this country. You are left out completely. And most of the time, you don't have company. And we are gregarious animals. We need affection and company. We need to be together. Before, the grandparents lived in the family with the grandchildren who grew up with the grandparents. It was a tribe, a little tribe, a community. Now that's not possible because modern life doesn't permit it, at least in this part of the world. And so we warehouse the grandparents in some nursing home or some place where they die alone, or they spend the rest of their possibly good years alone. That is scary. And the fact that that society is not aware what getting old is becoming, it means that we will have a very bad old age, most of us.
Now, here is where our paths come together. I have, for the last 3 years, been working on a documentary and a book to go along with it on medical aid in dying, which is to be shown across the country on public television next month.
Wow.
I believe so strongly in the right of people to choose near the end of their lives, whether to stay alive or whether to say, I am so close to death, I am ready to go, and I want a doctor to help me go. How do you feel about medical?
I talk about this exactly with your words in the book, about the right to die with dignity. And it's a human right. It is like the right to control your fertility, to have options about your fertility and not be forced to have children you don't want. You shouldn't be forced to live beyond what you think you can live. I was fortunate enough to be with my parents when they died a couple of years ago. My mother was 98 and my stepfather was 102.
Oh, my.
And they both died at home, well taken care of, accompanied in my arms. Ah. And I was so aware of the privilege that was and how it won't happen to me and it won't happen to most people. They were healthy and they did not die in pain, but I have seen people dying in pain, and it is unbelievable that they don't get the help they need. I think that some compassionate doctors do it, but it's not the right.
You live in California, where medical aid in dying is the law. So you could, in fact, have the quiet, peaceful, loving death that you want for yourself.
In California, yes, you're right. And in some other states also. But it should be everywhere, available everywhere.
And that's what I hope our film will prompt, is a discussion the likes of which you and I are having here. Has your relationship to work changed as you have grown older? Do you feel that you are more free to write as perhaps you might not have as a younger person?
I'm not in a hurry anymore. It's not about finishing a book. It's not about writing more. It's about enjoying the process. So I love what I do. I love telling stories.
Yes.
So I'm taking my time. And this last 3 months really, I have been promoting The Soul of a Woman in several languages on virtual, on Zoom all the time. So I have not had a chunk of time to sit down and write at leisure. And I am going to have that next week, starting next week. So I'm looking forward to that, but without any pressure. I don't put any pressure on myself anymore. I just want to enjoy it.
Do you write pretty much all day?
I write several hours. Before I could write 12 hours. And then when I would try to get up, I would be so stiff that I couldn't move. Now I don't do that. I walk the dogs, I exercise, I get up several times, I walk around, and I don't work more than 6 hours, sometimes seven. I have a husband also, that, and I need to pay some attention to him, you know.
I think in this time of COVID, so you...
I know. It's in the time of COVID that we were stuck, as I said, in this house. You know, but we in this time of forced intimacy, being inside together, we have had to exercise patience, tolerance, letting go, a sense of humor, kindness. Kindness gets you everywhere. It's really important. And I think we know each other much more than if we had lived together 10 years in normal circumstances.
Interesting. You know, as you talk about what's happened to women around the world, in your book, The Soul of a Woman, you talk about rape as a weapon of war and how widespread that has become. How do you see rape as it is going on in this?
There's nothing new about this. Rape has been prevalent forever. Since we have some written history, we know that that's the case. In every circumstances where there's a crisis, a war, occupation, whatever, first victims are women and children, and rape is the first thing that happens to women forever. It's nothing new about it. So it's not something that has happened because of feminism, as some people want to believe. No, it has happened always. Feminism is a reaction against that, not the cause of it. And this is part of what I was saying before, the war against women, which is the main pillar of the patriarchy. What is the patriarchy? It's a system of oppression that gives supremacy to the male gender over women, nature, other species, and many other men too, because not every man is an alpha male in the patriarchy. And what is feminism? It is an uprising against that system. So we are fighting the system, not the male gender, because of course we need men and we like men. It's not about that. It's about the system that needs to change.
It's a system
of oppression that is based on violence, greed, and competition. And women are the first victims.
And how much progress are we really making?
We are making progress. In my lifetime, I have seen the progress. You have seen it, Diane. And there is progress. But because I work in the world with organizations in other places in the world, I know that what we have achieved here is not what all women have at all. We are far from that, far. And what we have here is not enough either. So we still have a lot of work to do. And I will not see the end of the patriarchy in my lifetime, but my granddaughters might. So my job is to make it happen for them.
Here's another question from a listener who says, your first novels, House of the Spirits and Ava Luna, were magical realism. Some of your later works, including Long Petal of the Sea, are more historical fiction. I'm curious why you changed styles, what prompted the change, were there specific challenges to do so?
You know, all my books are different. I have tried different genres. I have tried historical fiction, literary novels with magic realism, without magic realism. I have tried young adult novels, even a book about aphrodisiacs, fiction, nonfiction, even a crime novel, Ripper. So I'm always curious about new things. Magic realism was very prevalent in Latin America between the 60s and the 80s. And then the literature moved away from that style. It became like too much. But the thing is that magic realism is not some Latin American literary device, a sort of trick. No, it's a way of seeing the world, of accepting that the world is a very mysterious place. We don't have all the answers. We don't control everything. And we have manifestations of things that appear to be magical because we don't have the explanation. If we didn't have an explanation for electricity, any electrical phenomena would be magical. So in Latin America, because we have that feeling that we don't control anything really, we have more the idea that the world is magical. But think of the United States. Think of the conspiracy theories. Aren't they magical thinking? Think of astrologers and horoscopes and crystals and gurus and those crazy preachers. All that is magical thinking. Most religions are magical thinking. So why attribute it only to Latin America? I don't know. And then I have some elements of magic realism in some of my books, in most of my books, but not in all of them. In a book like Long Petal of the Sea, which is a very particular event.
Yes.
It is the story of 2,200 Spanish refugees that escaped from the civil war in Spain and ended up being refugees in Chile. And they traveled in a ship called the Winnipeg that the poet Pablo Neruda bought for that purpose. It's a very particular event. There is no place there for magical realism at all, except the magical thinking that a character might have, but that's minimal.
Here's another question. What is your thought about what's going on at the U.S. southern border?
My foundation works in the southern border. We are helping organizations that are trying to protect the kids,
yes,
that are in detention centers and the ones that have been separated from the parents. But we also work on the other side of the wall in the refugee camps in Mexico, where the situation of women could not be more vulnerable and terrible, where people are kidnapped, assassinated, where the narcos are in control and crime is rampant, violence against women also. So we work there. And I'm telling you, we know 10% of what's really going on there. We see some images of kids in cages, but the extent of it, we have no idea in this country what our tax dollars are paying for. And it is appalling. It is shameful. And we will remember this in later generations as a terrible time, a shameful time.
A shameful time, and we hope that before long, our new president can address what's happening there and make things better in the countries from which those poor families come.
Exactly, Diane. That's the whole point. You have said exactly what's at the root of all this. Why people leave.
Yes.
There were no Syrian refugees 10 years ago. When the civil war in Syria started, refugees started to get out because they were running for their lives. And now we have more than 5 million Syrian refugees in Europe because they had to get out. Now, why do we have refugees that come from Central America? Because of the terrible conditions in Central America, especially in what is called the Triangle of the North, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And those conditions were created by a genocide against the indigenous people and with the idea of fighting in the Cold War against communism. All democratic governments that were leftist in those countries were eliminated with the help of the CIA, which also financed the military that took care of killing its own people. So now we have countries with failed governments that have been taken over by the gangs and by the narcos. And people cannot live there. They can't survive, so they get out in despair. And that is the reason. So unless the conditions in those countries are improved so that people can live with some safety, we will have refugees.
Well, my dear friend Isabel, I hope once this pandemic is beyond us and we are all able to travel safely again, I hope you and I can sit down across the table, have a cup of coffee, and talk with each other in person.
Yes, that would be lovely.
It has been wonderful.
It's wonderful to see you just as you were 20 years ago.
Oh, my dear.
With the same spirit and the same beauty.
Thank you so much, and the same right back to you. Thank you, Isabel.
Thank you.
That was Isabel Allende, author of 25 books, including a new memoir titled The Soul of a Woman. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.